It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
XX is brought to you by Club W, leading the grape-to-glass wine revolution. Answer just 6 simple questions at clubw.com, and their algorithm will create a palate profile just for you. Get wine directly to your door, perfectly customized to match your taste. For 50% off your first order, go to clubw.com/XX. And by bowlandbranch.com, the company that makes luxury bedding affordable. Get the nicest sheets you've ever owned for about half the price of what stores and boutiques are charging. Order right now, and they'll give you $50 off a set of sheets, plus free shipping. Go to bowlandbranch.com. That's bowlandbranch.com. And use the promo code XX. And by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter the offer code XX at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, October 1st. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer for Slate and the Atlantic. I'm joined not in the New York studios, but live in D.C. At the awesome Woolly Mammoth Theater, which is my favorite theater in D.C., by June Thomas. Hi, June.
Hello, Hannah. Hello, D.C.
Love you.
Oh. Good call.
And Noreen Malone.
Hi.
I don't know how to follow that. And the empty chair, which is for the Pope.
I wish.
Noreen's like a real Catholic, so really I take that back. I'm not supposed to make that
My mother will be very happy that you said that.
She'll be happy or unhappy?
That I'm a real Catholic? She'll be very happy.
Oh, no, that the Pope, that I, like, you know, made light of the Pope.
She's got a sense of humor.
Okay. All right.
That's good.
Okay. So our 3 topics today. First, we're going to talk about Carly Fiorina, because we all know she won the debate, but we don't really know what to think of her otherwise. Second is our special guest, Anne Marie Slaughter, on her new book, Unfinished Business, Women, Men, Work, and Family. And third, Generation Z, is that a real thing or something that marketers and the New York Times totally made up? The answer is. Okay, first, Carly Fiorina. We're just going to talk about her face. Is that okay? Okay. So she landed a lot of punches in the debate, especially against Donald Trump. Her answer to the face remark was perfect, inspiring, yet she seems to lie about a lot of things and inhabit a very confused kind of feminism. So since the debate is most recent, let's talk about what she said in the debate. Do you guys agree with me that that face comment, do you guys know, do we have to repeat what she answered to the face? Let's repeat what she answered to the face.
I'll be Trump.
You'll be Trump. Okay. Okay, you be Trump.
I had
okay,
so much ahead. Enthusiasm for that as well.
Well, you got to do your hair. Okay.
Look at that face. Would anyone vote for that?
But he didn't say that live, June. That's what he said to a Rolling Stone reporter. Yeah. Right. And so what happened live, Hannah? Tell us. You have it written down and I don't.
Oh, you mean what did she say? It was so awesome. It was really like, since we're in a theater, I have to say it was like theatrical delivery. I feel like she must have practiced that one a lot of times, right?
For sure. I mean, that would be the number one thing they would prep her for,
right?
Yeah,
but here's the thing. She did say this line.
She said, okay, because she paused. She took a meaningful look. Listeners, I'm looking meaningful right now. And then she said, I think women all over this country heard very clearly what Mr. Trump said. Psych. I shook my head, listeners. I'm doing exactly what I told you guys not to do. Visual cues. Okay, so can we just talk about why that was so awesome?
Well, it was even more awesome than that, because, yes, she said that, and she said it with fantastic aplomb, but also she made a kind of, you know, on the spur of the moment reference to the fact that Trump had, you know, held Jeb Bush's feet to the fire about something that he said that Jeb said he said, oh, it was misspoke. And she kind of said to Trump, well, you're going on at Jeb, but now you're not taking responsibility for what you've said. So she actually managed to, you know, not only get off this line that she'd pre-prepared, but also, you know, add a little twist to it.
Yeah.
So it was kind of impressive.
It was.
Well, and she got off another good line in her ads in advance and after the debate where she said, you know, I've earned every single one of these wrinkles, essentially. Like, I'm 61. You're looking at the face of experience, which I thought was also another smart way to handle it. Hannah, you're raising your hand.
Okay, raising my hand. She doesn't have any wrinkles. No, honestly, like, she ran a political ad about her wrinkles, and I was looking at her face. I was like, your face is, you're beautiful, lady, and I think you're beautiful, but you actually don't have any wrinkles.
So maybe you're quoting Trump then, because he said that too.
No, I mean, her face is lovely, but.
Maybe it's
no wrinkles. Yeah.
Maybe it's a coded message about her lack of experience in the government.
A few more things. I thought the line was surprising. I thought it was perfectly delivered. And I also thought it was like, this is where we can switch. It was very feminine. Like, it brought in all the pain of the women in the world. Like, it was really, really short, which is to say, like, that's as much as that crap deserves, like, this really short line. And nonetheless, it gathered all of womanhood together.
To talk about a schoolyard insult, like, I can't believe we're talking about someone calling a woman ugly, and that was her big feminist moment in 2015. Like, that's actually a little depressing when you think about it.
Well, that's actually, I never thought of Trump that way, that like he lowers the bar. His bar is so low on feminism that like anybody's a feminist. Like, by even a woman who like stands on the stage and is like, the fetuses that are writhing in that ad, which they are not writhing in that ad, like, even she counts as a feminist by Trump standards.
It's true.
Okay, so before we turn on Carly, because I can feel that we're about to turn on Carly, we're just like almost there. Before we turn on Carly, the other great moment, can you believe what, like, the $10 bill?
Okay, but did you like her answer that the question was basically bullshit? Did you respond
well,
to that?
Well, it's funny because we almost discussed this on the GabFest whenever this question of the $10 bill came out, and we ended up not talking about it. And what she gave that answer about symbolism, like, women are not token, they're not symbolic. That's like a cop-out feminism answer that's not quite a feminist answer, right? Like, she does that always on Silicon Valley. When her book came out, which is not called Hard Choices, but Tough Choices, which is very different than Hard Choices, because they're tough, but not hard. That's like a Veep moment, like when you like just like write all the names of the books. So in Tough Choices, when she was interviewed, she always walks that line of like, I'm not really saying that there's no glass ceiling, but I'm saying that there is a glass ceiling, but there isn't a glass ceiling. Get it?
Right. I mean, it's her whole line in the campaign is that women aren't a special interest group, right? That's how she's appealing. But then at the same time, she's saying to Republican voters, okay, women aren't a special interest group, but if you have me as your candidate, you'll be able to make sure that Hillary Clinton doesn't automatically win, you know, the war on women. So she's talking out of both sides of her mouth a little bit.
Right, because she's selling herself as a token candidate. She's doing ads which sort of appeal to womankind. The New York Times stories are like, finally, the Republicans have a way to reach women because they have a woman, and so that's a way to reach women because she's a woman. And so that's like totally obvious, right? Because she's female, and so you got us like that.
Do you guys find anything appealing at all about the idea of saying women aren't a special interest group? They're more than half the country. I find that refreshing to hear every once in a while. You know, it's a nice reminder. Or am I just being snowed?
I mean, except as Christina Cotarucci wrote in Slate, that as long as there are these terrible, you know, statistics about what women earn, the opportunities that they have, the, you know, the lack of childcare, the lack of all of these opportunities.
Oh, that.
Apart from that, it's not a special interest group. So, but I mean, also, it's just a smart tactic to draw attention, you know, especially with these overcrowded mass, you know, strands of people stood up arrayed on a stage. She does look different. I wasn't crazy about her dress, but I remember her dress. And I don't remember any of the guys' ties, although several were wearing red ones. But still, like...
Well, since June took it here...
I went there.
Her hair. So I read a...
Okay, her face?
Okay, I think we all might have read this 2010 Frank Bruni profile from the New York Times Magazine when she was running against Barbara Boxer in California, and she had much shorter hair then, and there's a great scene in the piece where she and her husband are talking about the way voters react to her, and they're very focused on, you know, the way people talk about her hair. They said she looks like, you know, I think punk was thrown around. Like, it was not scanning well with Republican voters, and you'll see now she has not even, like, soccer mom hair. It's, like, full, like, I would say... short of an Anna Wintour bob, but kind of in that direction, like power lady hair, but it's definitely more feminine. So she, again, we are on the most shallow Donald Trump levels now, but it's obviously been a conscious decision.
Well, nothing is accidental at that level, of course.
Yeah. Now we can talk about her lying, right? So like, here's what I noticed. No, it was much written about, and she had this like really kind of serious pissing match with that Yale business professor who wrote this really long piece about what a big liar she was and how terrible a CEO she was. It was like the Politico magazine front page story. Seemed very well deserved. It even had bullet points like, she is a liar because A, she is a liar because B, like it really just, it went on and on and on. But here's the thing that she's mastered, which I'm really actually kind of envious of. When she lies, she does extra power pose. So she's like, do you know what I mean? Like, she has mastered the power pose, that thing like, I'm not giving like an inch of vulnerability or hesitation. I'm like lying, but I am not going to be like, that is not going to drop my confidence level at all.
Is that something you want in an elected official or not?
That's just something like, you know, we can ask Anne Marie about this, but like that's just something that is discussed around like women in the workplace and like whether you're supposed to show confidence and whether that works. So it's like, I feel like all the time that I was watching her in the debate, I was imagining her power pose coach. And like I was imagining Carly Fiorina looking in the mirror, and the power pose coach was like, more, Carly, like more. Like, just give it harder. And you know, so in the end when she was, and then it all crescendoed in her completely imaginary but extremely vivid description of that Planned Parenthood video that never happened. You know, so that's the kind of thing she did.
So is she dangerous? So I got a text from a friend who lives on the West Coast. I got it in the middle of the night, and so it was extra scary. but she had just watched the debate, and she said, "Do I love Carly Fiorina?" with like 8 question marks, and she wasn't sure what to think. She's like a good liberal feminist, and she had this great reaction to Carly Fiorina from having watched that debate. So should we be worried, or is she just going to become, you know, a vice presidential candidate, and then maybe not even the vice president?
I felt a little confused. That's why I was happy that we were discussing this topic, because, like, you know, and that, like, the same order as your friend, I later, to prepare for this topic, I watched, somebody had compiled all the highlights of Carly Fiorina during the debate to this heavy metal song, Let the Bodies Hit the Floor. And so the music for Let the Bodies Hit the Floor and her power pose and her, like, blue suit and her, like, kicking Trump's ass. And I was like, yeah, but I hate you. But yeah, like, it was a terrible, terrible internal moment I was having. So
did you have that moment?
I was hoping you guys would, like, disabuse me of all that.
Well, I hate to draw this comparison, but it's sort of the inevitable one. Did you have that moment at all when Sarah Palin came onto the scene? Before everything.
Every time.
Like, every time.
Every time, like, when, even when I see the movie about Sarah Palin coming on the scene and, like, lipstick on a pig, like, I'm still, like, I'm moved. I'm like, you badass Sarah Palin. Like, you go, girl. No, yeah. No, 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 no.
So that's what I mean. I think there must be something inherently appealing about the Republican brand of female candidate, that it's so shocking to us to see ideas we completely disagree with presented in a way that we can't look away from, you know?
But
like,
there is,
it's like,
but,
sex, okay, appeal for policy or something. I don't know. It's
but there is, okay, but there is, do you, for example, there is a moment in every election when, like, a certain number of women win, and then a kind of feminist-minded writing will discount the Republican women who win. And you think, well, that can't really be the real world, right? Like, we have to just be happy that there's a diversity of viewpoints, and you have to hope that they'll, you know, sort of, it can't be that we, like, automatically dismiss any woman who's not pro-choice as somehow good, or am I wrong about that? Or is it the opposite, where, like, we shouldn't care if it's a man or a woman, we should just care if they're good for the cause of women. Those are, like, two frameworks about judging, you know, what's good in politics and policy.
Well, I grew up in Margaret Thatcher's Britain, and so I know that it's not, you know, a woman doesn't guarantee, you know, that you're going to be happy by any means. And it's this particular array of candidates. I mean, those GOP candidates they're all weird. Like, none of them. I mean,
John Kasich is not weird, but everybody else is weird.
But, like, she was absolutely killed by Barbara Boxer in 2010. She, you know, her record at Hewlett-Packard was not good, no matter how much, you know, that's another thing that she lies about. And Barbara Boxer made an ad that talked about, it was essentially like the Mitt Romney ad about his, you know, the 47% or his huge wealth or what, and she's prone to exactly those same sins. Yeah. So I think maybe we're grading on a curve because she's the only, because the rest are really awful.
And because Trump's been like a kind of sexist weirdo, and so she fights him back more effectively than anybody else. So there's some satisfaction in watching that happen in real time. Anyway, anything more on Carly Fiorina? We good? Okay.
She's a beautiful woman with a beautiful face. I just want to say that for the record.
And she has wrinkles, but they're not really that wrinkly. Okay. We're going to move on to our next topic with our guest, Anne-Marie Slaughter. Before we do that, I would like to thank our sponsor. Boll & Branch is a sheet company. We all spend a third of our life in bed. June and I had a discussion about this. Where I was like, those lazy bastards. And she was like, but we do spend a third of our life in bed. It's like 8 hours that we spend, which is true. You sleep for 8 hours. The reason I like Boll & Branch is because they're a very slate-y company, because they have disabused me of all sorts of stereotypes I have about sheets. Thread count, not a thing. A total marketing myth that literally means nothing. Egyptian cotton, not a thing. The cotton is made in Pakistan and China. So anyway, store markups are something like 800%. So this is why you should buy from Boll & Branch. They say they make the most comfortable sheets in the world from crazy soft organic cotton. And you never worry about them being made in sweatshops like a whole lot of bedding that's out there. Boll & Branch has made luxury bedding affordable. When you buy bedding, you're paying 800% markup. I said that already. So you don't want to do that anymore because you want to buy directly online at bollandbranch.com. That's B-O-L-L and B-R-A-N-C-H. They're so confident that you can try them risk-free for 30 nights. If you order right now, they'll give you $50 off a set of sheets plus free shipping. bollandbranch.com. Use the promo code XXDOUBLEX. Okay.
Awesome.
Awesome. Let's welcome our guest, Anne-Marie Slaughter. Hi, Anne-Marie. Welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Anne-Marie's new book is just about to come out, Unfinished Business, Women, Men, Work, and Family. She's also the president and CEO of the New America Foundation, professor emerita at Princeton, first woman director of policy planning at the State Department. She worked for Hillary. She wrote the most read article in the Atlantic's history and is married and has two boys. Are you telling us that women still can't have it all? Like, it's been like a couple of years. They still can't have it all? Anyway, I hope you all saw her op-ed in the New York Times called A Toxic Work World. I loved that framing because it was not about women. Though we are a show about women, I really appreciated that framing. So can you maybe talk to us about this idea that the work world is inhumane as opposed to we are lame?
Absolutely.
Because I like that better.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. Although I would just, first of all, call out the fabulous work Jody Cantor has done writing for the New York Times, talking about Amazon and Starbucks, also not as as women's problems, but as work problems. And that's really one of the key messages of my book, which is, you know, we are accustomed to the story, well, we've got a women problem. We don't have enough women, so it's clearly women who are dropping out. And in fact, what we have is a work culture that is still basically aimed at a kind of leave it to beaver family, where you assume there's somebody at home to take care of whoever needs taken care of, and that's not true, and that's a work problem.
Although I, you know, reading that Amazon actually also left me conflicted because I thought we all think of Amazon as possibly the most effective company that exists now. So what it left in my head is actually, you know, is a company that values care and humanity a company that isn't effective?
So
I hope not.
No, definitely not. Part of that is, I actually had a different reaction to that article, which is there was this one woman describing, you know, how she worked around the clock so that some kid could get a Barbie, I don't know, an hour sooner than otherwise.
Right.
And I thought, whoa, those are not my values. I mean, and what I argue is any one company can do that. It's like a health insurance company just taking the most healthy people, and then when they're not healthy, then letting other people insure them. But if you look at all companies, if we don't make room for care, you simply lose a huge amount of talent, and ultimately you've got all sorts of problems of not being able to retain talent, not being able to recruit it, but also the economy can't sustain that.
Mm-hmm. But Anne-Marie, one of the things that I kept thinking when I was reading your book is all the points are so undeniable. And yet, you know, as you note at several points in it, you know, the U.S. in several metrics, you know, these things like it was only Liberia and Papua New Guinea and the United States, you know, have these, don't have, you know, good parental or family leave provision, all of these terrible things that the U.S. is an outlier on. But why? Because even if it's a woman problem, which we agree it's not, but even if it were, that would be at least half the country that you would think would be an interest group that politicians would worry about. But when everybody's involved, why isn't anything happening? Why are we still such an outlier in this country?
Yeah, I talk about in my other life as a foreign policy commentator, I'm quite familiar with American exceptionalism, and this is not such great exceptionalism. So, but it is true we do things our own way. We're outliers on all sorts of OECD rankings because we don't believe in the state. I mean, that's the bottom line. There are all sorts of things the state provides in England and other advanced industrial countries that we don't. But I think there's a... I mean, we have gotten to the point now where this is affecting women, but this is increasingly affecting men. And sadly, it's only when it really affects men, where there are enough men who are saying, wait a minute, why didn't I get paternity leave? And wait a minute, I went part-time and I want to come back on, that then suddenly people will pay much more attention. I mean, to go back to Carly Fiorina, there are interest groups for women, but there are not interest groups for family. There's no interest group for care. There's no interest group that says, wait a minute, you know, half of what we used to do, we now need to provide through some other meaning than women at home.
So why did men come into the picture? Like, why is this suddenly a topic of concern to men?
Well, partly you're going to talk about Generation Z. So some of this really are, I think, millennial men who were raised by two working parents who expect to be able to be fully equal parents and suddenly discover that their wives are getting offered far more leave than they are. And they're saying, well, wait a minute, I don't get this. I want to be able to be just as involved in my child's life, and you're discriminating against me. So some of it is just generational. I mean, I'm about to be 57. My lifetime and the women's movement are coterminous, and it took 20 years, even to get a few women into the workforce, right? 1980. By 1990, you're getting more. Now you have many more, but we're still not rising to the top. But now we have kids who are raised by both working mothers and working fathers. That's a big part of it.
Amory, you have a part in your book where you talk about, you know, you need to plan this out in a number of different ways, including talking to your partner about, yes, you know, what to do. And you have a number of different highly specific scenarios. You know, one person gets offered a promotion, but it involves moving across the country. It involves the other person giving up their promotion. So is this like date number two where you bust this out? Like, when do you do that?
I've been thinking a lot about that. This is what I call the conversation. And so, you know, for those of you who are contemplating...
It has to be like the other conversation. Conversation is like, so do you love me? Yeah.
Right. Like, you love me. But so you've gotten past the, you love me, we're going to
be together.
We're going to hook up in some way, but no.
We're past that. That's like,
that's not what I mean.
Are we going to hook up? These days that's a conversation.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Are we going to be life partners? And
yes.
What I say is, you know, at that point, most young men and women will say, of course, I believe in your career, and of course, I believe in your career. And that's just not good enough. The question has to be, okay, if you're the woman, so if I get a promotion, will you move for me? So if you look at women CEOs, they frequently move like 10 times. That's how you get to be CEO. Or if we both get offered a promotion, will you defer your promotion so I can take mine? Or, as has happened in my marriage, my husband has a great career, but as he wrote, he didn't intend to be lead parent. Are you willing to be lead parent, meaning the available one, the person who will travel less, who will be there for all the unpredictable things that caring for kids is about? And if you really have to contemplate those things, because most men who are completely committed to equality have never thought about it in terms of equality may mean I have to defer my career so you can take yours.
But what if you find ambition very attractive in a man? So what does that do to the conversation? Which I feel like a lot of people who are themselves highly driven find really great in a partner.
Yes. And both my husbands. yes, I find ambition very attractive in a man. I definitely do. Andy is certainly ambitious. I will say I'm more ambitious. I mean, I am driven in a way that he would say he's not. And I find that this is really a highly individual thing. Of course, you know, intelligent, well-educated people who are committed to their careers look for the same things in a spouse often. But we are just accustomed to still, even now, we think it's okay for a guy to be ambitious. It's not really okay for a woman to be ambitious. Somebody was writing recently, someone was just saying to me that her husband's friends say, you know, your wife, Kathy, is really quite ambitious. That's not a compliment. Still not. But men don't pay that penalty. And my view is, wait a minute. There's you know, there's a spectrum between very nurturing and cutthroat competitive, and men and women fall on different places in that spectrum. And you can marry somebody who's very ambitious, but who says, you know, look, you are really driven in this career, and you also have opportunities. I mean, it's luck too. And I'm going to be the person who supports you in doing that. And I mean, Hannah, you talked about seesaw marriages in your book. You know, ideally, you'll be able to flip. But even if you can't, you know, my husband gets a great career, but he also gets a relationship with our kids that is harder for me to have, or I have a different relationship.
So how did it happen in your, we're so Oprah right now, but okay. How did it actually happen in your marriage? I'm thinking in my own head as you're talking, how did it happen in my marriage? And it didn't happen because of a conversation, it just happened. Like it just suddenly like happened. Like David did one thing, I did another thing. It just like slowly over time, we each like ended up occupying different niches and being vaguely supportive and happily ever after.
So Andy would say
until David took a job in New York. And then, no, I'm just kidding. Go ahead. Yeah.
So Andy would say the same thing, and he's written about this, so I'm not going to divulge anything he hasn't written. But he would say, you know, yes, we didn't have a conversation. Are you going to be lead parent? We didn't have any concept of that. We were both teaching. We had kids. I deferred a couple of things I could have put myself up for because we had two little kids. But then I got this offer to go be dean at Princeton, and not only did he not get an offer to be dean, he would die rather than be a dean, right? He would wake up every morning and say, thank God you're willing to do this job because I never am. Mm-hmm. But deans, you know, that's administration, that's higher up. Once I was dean, that led to an offer to go to Washington. So it was chance. As he said, you know, big jobs tend to breed other big jobs. And then we got to a point where I'm here and he's there. And at that point, he became lead parent. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't always that way.
And do you think, like, among your women friends, like, how much judgment is there on that? Like, that you're the more ambitious one in the relationship?
Well, one of our good friends said, in every relationship, somebody is the turbine and the other person's the brake. And there's not been much doubt in I'm the turbine, he's the brake. That we need both, right? Uh-huh. Otherwise, we go off the rails. I think most of our friends would say we're both ambitious by the standards of the population. You know, everybody in this room probably is ambitious. But I think they would say we're a really good match because he's willing to be the person who really can support me in a way I can have a career. And I find him fabulously attractive.
Okay, Noreen, as a youth.
Thank
this
you.
This is the time in the show where Noreen gets to play the youth. As
I'm Noreen rapidly aging out of this. Yeah, you're gonna have to replace me.
Well, only they can see that. Like, for the listeners, we could just be like, you'll be prepared. Even like 25 years from now, I'll be seeing Noreen as the youth on the show. Do your friends? Is it more explicit or is it the same? Like it just bubbles up organic. Like, could you imagine your friends who are, you know, in serious relationships actually explicitly having these conversations?
Yeah, I think people do have these conversations. I think a lot of times it ends up being kind of a more traditional setup and they have those conversations. But I do have a friend who just started a new job and we were talking about how difficult it was for her and she's complained to her husband about it a bunch. And he said, you have to sack up. You have to do this for our family, which I thought was something that, you know, a guy 20 years ago, first of all, maybe not would not have used that metaphor with his wife, but also would not have thought in that way. He might have been like, well, you know, time for me to step in. This is overwhelming for you. Instead, he was like, this is your moment. This is the time that you're doing it.
Yeah. Andy actually said the same thing after my article came out and made such a big splash. And I was like, I'm not going to write a book. And he's like, oh, yes, if you get an offer, write a book.
Amri, one of the things in the book that you call for is a sort of moving to appreciating care and caregiving.
Yes.
And that seems like one of those sort of calls that's undeniable. And I love, too, that you're very optimistic. However, again, what's the first step? Because there's, you know, I could now, you know, throw out five or six different reasons why that wouldn't happen, but that would just be negative. What's a more optimistic sort of view of how we can get companies to be more appreciative of caring, to give a higher value on caregiving?
So I think the first step is that we as women, double X, we need to re-socialize ourselves. I mean, this is the hard part, because we do not believe that caring for children is as important as being a journalist, as being a lawyer, as being whatever we are. I certainly, Hannah and I, and June, you, we were raised to think that our dad's work was more important than our mother's work. And the hardest part of writing this book was actually re-socializing myself and actually realizing, wait just a minute. In the first place, taking care of children is really hard. And second, it's incredibly important. It's important individually, but it's also important as a society. It has also made me a far better leader. I am so much better at what I do because I'm a parent. I think, I'm not sure it works in the other direction, but parenting is so unpredictable and uncertain. That's what makes it so hard. So until we believe that, companies aren't going to believe that, because we buy in completely to the idea that what matters is men's work. And my point is, A, you can't do that. You can't have a halfway revolution. You can't say it used to be that both taking care of families and earning a living were two full-time jobs. My mother was not exactly lying around eating bonbons. She was working really hard. But now we're going to have women, you know, be breadwinners, but we're going to just leave care the way it used to be. It won't work. And the second thing I'd say is, if women had run the world from the beginning, caring for families would have been important from the beginning. It's only that men ran the world, and this was the work men did, and so we think that's more important. So if we believe it, and certainly, you know, things like the U.S. military believe it, they understand. If you don't invest in the next generation, we can't defend ourselves, we're economically not competitive.
Just tell us more about what the Pentagon does, because that was mind-blowing.
Yeah, the Pentagon, first place, pays early education teachers the same as K through 12 teachers. It provides leave for maternity and paternity leave, and it basically recognizes that investing in the next generation is a national security issue.
I was just flashing in my mind to the Halo Dad days.
Yes, like, there was we all
a
have
guy, them. It's so annoying. There was like a guy, he's actually now a friend of mine, who sat a desk behind me when I was working at the newspaper. And he and I had children exactly the same time. And I would hear him, like, you know, saying to his colleagues, well, I gave the baby a bath last. And everyone was like, whoa. It's like, I do that every night.
Exactly. That's Halo Dad as
yeah. A bath. He'd be like, a bath. I did the bath. You know,
that's true. But to be fair, I mean, look, there are a growing number of men who are really being equal parents. And part of my point also is guys are missing out a lot who don't actually have that kind of relationship with their kids.
Did men write you that? Like when you wrote the article, is part of the reason the article morphed into the book because you heard from a lot of men?
Absolutely. And I have to say, I was really surprised. I'd say about 20% of the letters I got were guys saying, you think that I like it this way. You think men have it all. We've got our careers and families on weekends and evenings, and that's great. But frankly, I would much rather be able to have much more choice about how much time I spend with my children. I am required to be the breadwinner. I don't have choice. And one of the things I realized was we're raising our daughters to have lots of choices. They can be lead parent. They can have careers. They can mix it. They can do it sequentially. We are raising our sons to still be the breadwinner. I mean, your worth as a man is determined by your career, how much money you bring home. And that, again, it seems kind of preposterous, but when you think about it for a second, you think that can't be right, right? Guys have to have an equal range of choices. And in the perfect world, nobody has to be all one or all the other, right? You can seesaw, you can, you know, you can go really hard till your mid 30s, you can take time out for caregiving, you can go hard again. But you ought to have those choices.
Here's what I genuinely worry about. This gets back to June's first question about, like, there's a reason why we're one of three countries that doesn't have paid maternity leave, and that's, like, really pathetic, and it's been that way for a really long time. Is there something deep in the American psyche, and I've asked this in, like, three different ways, but it's a belief strong in my head that I'm really trying to work out, that just, like, believes that success can't leave a space for humanity in the workplace. That the reason that the American economy is so successful is very closely connected to the fact that we don't allow the person to be a full human being in the workplace. Like, we just can't open up that space. The American workplace thinks like Amazon is why we kick ass and why we're successful. Like, maybe. I mean, if you call the bottom 20%, like, that's how you make a good company.
Well, and the solution that people are offering to this a lot of the times is, like, flex work, which often comes with your benefits being taken away. So you can either be a full person in the workforce and you know, talk about having to work for your family and not have health insurance, or you can just go the whole hog and just never see your family.
Yeah, like, it's like American has skipped over the humane workplace and right into the Uber economy, mm-hmm. like, without fixing the problem in the middle, you know?
So a couple of responses. One is, yes, that was the story about Amazon, but at the same time, there have been stories about how Google and Facebook and LinkedIn and other tech companies are competing on paternity leave, right? So suddenly that tells you, A, there's a demand for it, and B, these companies are willing to provide it if that's what is needed. So there are other examples at the sort of new economy companies that I think are more promising. But the other is, when I was listening to you, I thought, yeah, that's exactly what it was like at the turn of the last century. We didn't even have any regulation of working hours, right? You could be required to work 16 hours a day. And when states tried to regulate working hours, it was struck down by the Supreme Court as a violation of freedom of contract, right? And that was the way the Supreme Court believed that until basically Roosevelt threatened to pack it. So there have been these periods in American history where, you know, just absolute Wild West capitalism prevailed, and there were no human values whatsoever. And then we actually said, you know, we can't run an economy this way. We need an 8-hour workday. We need worker safety. We need protections. And we're going to get there again. We are in the similar sort of trajectory where we've got new technologies, we've got huge income inequality, we've got unbelievable exploitation of the people at the bottom, but there's a backlash coming. So I don't think we're going to do it the way other countries do. I don't think we're going to have a year's some kind of maternity leave, I know, as Britain does. I don't think, but could we get to a place where we have 6 weeks? Yes. For women and men? Yes. That we have paid family leave in New Jersey under Chris Christie. We have paid family leave, and it's paid for, like, you know, any mm-hmm. kind of payroll tax. So we can get to a much better place than we can now. But we won't be Finland.
All right, let's end on that almost optimistic note. We'll go to our third topic. Thank you, Anne-Marie, and we'll bring you back for questions. Okay, before we go to our third topic, we hear from June.
And I am here with the second sponsor's message today. Now, I don't know about you all, but I like to drink wine, sure. But I actually know nothing about wine, and I'm kind of intimidated by it. Like, I don't know anything about it, it's just too much. But our sponsor, Club W, is going to solve that problem. It's awesome! So with Club W, you just go there, and you just answer 6 simple questions.
It's an internet club, not a real life club.
Yeah, an internet club, yeah. Say, pass the wine. Yes, no. It's an internet club. It creates a palate profile just for you. And then they send you wine that is suited to your palate profile. They work directly with vineyards to cut out the middlemen, which saves you money. So with Club W, you get premium wine customized to your taste at a third of what you'd pay at the store. They even have a no-risk 100% guarantee that they'll love what they send you. Right now, Club W is offering the XX GabFest listeners 50% off their first order, which is magnificent, when you go to clubw.com/XX, DOUBLEX. So stop wasting time and money. Just go to clubw.com/XX to get 50% off your first order. That's clubw.com/XX.
Generation Z. All right, listeners and audience here, we debated about this topic because everyone was like, bullshit, bullshit. But I promise you, you're going to hear a lot about Generation Z in your future, so we can together figure out if it's total bullshit right here, and then you will know, okay? So I'm just going to say a few things that they are saying. They, the media and the marketers about Generation Z. They are conscientious, they're hardworking, they're cautious. Entrepreneurship is in their DNA. Did you just hear that sentence I said? Entrepreneurship is in their DNA. It's not in their DNA. That's not a thing, okay? Okay, marketers are starting to pounce on what they're calling Generation Z, which is anyone 5 to 19. Like my daughter. You know, often with these things, like, there'll be, like, embarrassing old person moments. Like, when I read that Vine story in The New Yorker, and I was like, oh, my God. My daughter was like, that was, like, 2012, you know? All those people. And but with this, I actually was with my daughter and some of her friends early this morning, and they were like, what's Generation Z? So, you know, you heard it here first.
I think that means it's not real if the teens don't know about it.
No, it means we're, like, really cutting edge. That's what it means. Right. Okay. So what do you think Generation Z is? First, let's define it. Like, well, what age is it?
I don't care. I'm just excited that they're not talking about millennials anymore.
Yes.
Millennial. I'm just...
But do you think that's the whole reason Generation Z was invented by millennials, so people would stop talking about millennials?
Maybe. Millennials are increasingly in positions of power. I mean, I think to a certain degree, all of this generational stuff is bullshit somewhat. But I, as an older millennial, have begun to notice that none of these descriptions of young people apply to me anymore. And so I'm relieved that I don't have to pretend to fit into them anymore. Because it is true that people who grew up fully with the internet, people who grew up fully in the wake of 9/11, they've genuinely lived in a different world. And they are going to think about things in a very different way than I do.
Okay, so before we dismiss it, let's say what they are saying about Generation Z. So this is not what we are saying. It's what they, the other people. So for one thing, this is the rubric that I thought of, and you can fill in the details and tell me if this is wrong or right, that like the millennials are like the guy you date and the Generation Z is the guy you marry. Is that right? Well, like the millennials are like self-absorbed and they're narcissistic and they can't make any money and they la la la. And
I'm right here.
I'm right here.
It's all about me. Yeah, I mean, Generation Z sounds great, but they're idealistic young kids. Wait till they get out into the real world and have to deal with things.
But to me, they sound like old people.
Well, that was one of the most interesting points this New York Times Style Section article made, was that they share a lot in common with the Silent Generation, which came of age during the Depression. You know, the sort of greatest generation. Those are interchangeable, right? Silent and greatest.
How can you be great?
It seems like they want to be ethical consumers, which again to me sounds a little bit like the idealism of youth. But they do seem to have pretty cool taste when, you know, they do. It's like Lorde and Tavi Gevinson and all, like.
But that's just like who's cool right now. So like when whatever the millennials liked was cool then. And like
well,
saying,
yeah,
like
Paris that age always decide what's cool.
What?
People of that in that age group, not born in those years, they always decide what's cool.
Yeah, but the thing the New York Times story did is just like list who's cool at this moment and list who was cool at that moment and say they're more cooler now. But like, sure, because it's now. But they didn't like actually get into like why, you know, why. I mean, they did with Hannah Horvath. Like Hannah Horvath becomes from Girls, becomes like the millennial pain in the ass, right?
And the person I was, the part even of that, you know, hugely laden with, you know, bull feces article, the thing that was least convincing was that Alex Dunphy from Modern Family, which is to say the middle kid, the nerdy scholastic kid, is the uber Generation Z. When, like, why wouldn't her brother Luke also be? He's the same. Like, ugh, come on.
Oh, he's the same generational, but he's like Hannah Horvath.
Yeah,
right.
So, it, like, yeah, no. But, yeah, I just think that all... I just can't.
I will just to be totally honest, we suggested this topic and June was like, no. So...
Yeah, you said you weren't going to talk.
I wanted to talk about nuns. Come on.
Yeah, June wanted to talk about nuns. Like, I suggested this to nuns. June was like, nuns, nuns, nuns.
Do we have any nuns in the room?
Yeah.
No.
No.
Carry on.
Okay, wait. So, Hannah, you are a classic parent of a Gen Zer because you yourself are Gen X. And to me, that's one of the more interesting aspects of the generational sort of theory, that millennials tend to be kids of boomers, which I am, and you are a Gen Xer with a... So do you... Is it weird to see your own values refracted through, like, a younger... Like, your generational values, what those look like, you know, forced upon a young person?
Yeah, I was actually thinking about that. And now I'm going to do my favorite thing, which is read marketing documents. Okay, so here are the things I caused in my child. I love marketing language. They lack situational awareness.
What does that mean?
What the hell does that mean? I have no idea what that means.
Is it like...
What does that mean? They're all on the spectrum? What does that mean?
Yeah, it does it.
I don't know, but I love marketing documents. Okay, they communicate with symbols. Like, does that mean they're dolphins? What is
that? I mean, so did Prince, but he's not Generation Z.
I think that means, like, emojis.
Yeah.
Did I cause... emojis?
Actually, I mean, emojis were kind of originally created in, I think, the 90s by a, like, Microsoft or one of those Seattle tech company employees. So kind of your generation caused emojis.
Rosebud. Okay. Okay, here's one that I did cause. This is one that I can take credit for. They are drawn to social media, which disintegrates and self-destructs. That's because we watched a lot of James Bond movies when we were young. No, but that you can see because, like, we caused shame upon, what was her name? Crystal. Remember that politician?
Crystal Ball.
Crystal Ball. No, that was that, every time I forget her name, I'm like, her name was not really Crystal Ball, but her
you
name
bring
was
her up
actually
so
Crystal
much.
Ball.
You are like her number one
I
fan.
I am her number
I feel
one
like
fan.
Twice a year.
Everyone has forgotten about Crystal except me.
She's on MSNBC.
Crystal alone.
But we caused that, right?
No, I think millennials caused that because she's a millennial. I think it's like millennials screwed up so much on social media that Gen Z wisely decided that they were going to get Snapchat.
I mean, you know, like, how do you experience this in your own children? Like, the idea that my daughter would, like, lavishly pour upon her photos and curate her Facebook page, it's just like Snapchat done. It's an attention span thing. It's not like a shame or like, I want to run for office and I'm very earnest and I'm interested in social entrepreneurship and I'm in my DNA. It's like, I'm bored. So here's the picture. It's gone. You know?
Some of those things that you've just said, though, make me realize that, not you, of course, but we... This is the generation of helicopter parents who are so desperate to get their kids into those few desirable schools that they, you know, tiger mom them. And then that would cause kids to be like that, potentially. All those
okay, but I like wrote the article, The Overprotected Kid, so I didn't cause that.
But
I'm
no,
not
wait,
taking credit for
one,
that.
One
I
of
uncaused
these,
that.
One of these marketing documents I was reading, or maybe it was even in the Times piece, said that actually Gen Xers aren't helicopter parents. They're like, I forget the it was like a very bellicose metaphor, but it was like they kind of go across enemy lines. It's like sniper parenting, maybe? It was very, seriously, like it's...
Oh my God, that's such a good term.
I don't know if it was. I don't quote me on that, but it was something like that. Where it's like targeted kind of strikes on the kids instead of just always worrying about them.
But this is like Carly Fiorina. It's just like a bunch of bullshit, and you say it like really, really powerfully. Like, they're the children of Gen Xers, and they were helicopter parented, and so they like Snapchat.
Done.
Okay. Please just let me indulge me just like one more, okay? Because I love marketing language. Okay. Blockbusters like The Hunger Games and Divergent depict teens being slaughtered. No wonder Gen Z developed coping mechanisms. Come on.
Like, I have no response to that one. That's an amazing sentence.
I'm not even going to, but here's another thing that was confusing to me. They fact check everything. They have access to tools unthinkable for earlier generations. Think, well, yeah, the second part is true. They are digital natives, but do they really fact check everything? Maybe they do. I don't know these children.
Fact-checking is like...
You
do. Fact-checking is like a job performed by fact-checkers. So I don't actually know what that means. Like, well, I mean, my children do correct me all the time, but that's because their father corrects me all the time. And so that's... I don't think of that as generational. I just think of that as a habit.
That's in their DNA.
That's in their DNA. Hell yes. Okay, so now I'm just going to do this. This is actually The Cut, New York Magazine, your magazine, did a pretty funny story making fun of the Gen Z concept, and they had some sentences you can try out if you want to appear to be a Gen Z person, which I think would be difficult for me, but, you know, you could maybe pull it off, Maurice. I contribute to Rookie. Want to take a snap? And this is the good one. I wanted to get a part-time job this summer, but my small startup that makes food out of hemp is taking up a bit too much time.
All right,
come on. You know, in a few years, like, Gen Z is going to be an established concept, like all of these other things. It has to be. It happens in every generation.
But let's get to the next question, which is much more interesting, which is, what's the one after that?
Yeah.
Do we start over? Is it like AA?
And what happened to Y?
Well, apparently Y were the millennials, but the millennials rejected it.
Yeah, but most millennials do not want to be identified as millennials. It's a really hated term. There
Why?
Was a poll by...
So Rebecca Onion wrote a wonderful piece in Aeon, is that how you pronounce it, magazine? In which she said, reading these characters, she was talking about the general bullshitness of generational labels. She was disgusted with millennials, so she's a millennial, I mean with the label of millennial, so she's a millennial. But she said, reading these characteristics feels like browsing a horoscope, which I thought was really, that is what it feels like, right? I see myself in some of these traits, can feel a vague thrill, but it's not really who I am. It's like you can sort of recognize yourself vaguely as some of these things, and I can definitely say about the children of my daughter's generation that they do have a kind of pragmatic cynicism, and they are very like, I'm going to start my own company. Like the number of young kids who just think it's like that to sort of start their own company, they have a different relationship to diversity, a much more natural relationship to both gender diversity, and it's not like a concept they have to be taught, you know? Like I think a lot of us are maybe we're not digital natives, but okay, whatever.
We're bilingual at this point.
But they are kind of a gender spectrum and diversity natives, I think. Is that okay? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's super true.
Yeah.
Not just true, super true.
Have we run out of things to say about Generation Z?
I did a long time ago, just
remember. Okay.
Hey. This is Ann Hepperman, Double X Gabfest's producer, with a word from our third sponsor for today's show, Squarespace. Squarespace sites look professionally designed, regardless of your skill level. No coding is required. They're intuitive and have easy-to-use tools. Accounts start at $8 a month, and you get a free domain if you sign up for a year. So start your free trial site today. No credit card is required at squarespace.com. And when you sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the Double X offer code, Double X, that's DOUBLEX, to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
Okay, recommendations. Noreen, you go first.
I'm going to do two. One, I realize I may have done the last time I was in Washington for a live show, but I'm going to say it again just in case I didn't.
None.
My favorite book about Washington is called Reputation by Marjorie Williams. It's a series of profiles that she wrote. And if you haven't read it, or if you read her other book, The Woman at the Washington Zoo, it's worth seeking out.
I like Xerox certain profiles from that book and keep them on my desk.
So
that's
good.
How good
so
they
good.
Are. Yeah.
And then the other one is a piece, I'm going to root for the home team here, my home team, a piece in New York Magazine this week by Alex Morris about, I don't remember the name of the article itself, but it's about women who their wives used to be their husbands. So it's about what it's like to be married to someone who's going through a gender transition. That person is having this cathartic moment and the feelings that are around that and what the nature, and it ends up being about what the nature of love really is. And it's great.
Are they happy? Are they conflicted? Like, what are they, how do they
I think
feel?
It's a like combination of all of the feelings you could possibly have about that. But what I found really moving about it was that for the most part that they stayed together, at least the women who were in this article.
So maybe we should talk about that on our next show.
Maybe.
Maybe. All right, I'm going to go next. I have two things to recommend. So this show is part of the Women's Voices Theater Festival, which is going on in D.C., which is a fabulous festival. And I'm sorry, this is the competing theater arena stage, another theater that I love. My very good friend who lived next door to me in college, Karen Zacharias, has an amazing play called Destiny of Desire. And since you're all D.C. people, I can recommend that to you. I've watched it sort of in its insemination because she's a good friend of mine. And it's a hilarious play about telenovelas. It's like a spoof of telenovelas, and it's simultaneously a telenovela and a spoof about telenovela, and it has so many funny lines in it. Anyway, it was really fantastic. And I have a second recommendation. I've already recommended the podcast You Must Remember This on this show. In fact, I probably did it last show. But I am recently listening to there's 13 episodes. It seems like too many, but it is not, about Charles Manson's Hollywood. And they are so good. It's like I've listened to like 40 hours about Charles Manson's Hollywood and like loved every hour of it. So there you go.
Hannah, did you know that You Must Remember This is now a Panoply podcast?
Ah, okay. So in the family, the yeah. Panoply podcast. I didn't know that. June.
So I'm going to recommend something which I've already recommended on another podcast, which seems like a cheat, but it's so good. I want to make sure everybody who listens to the Double X Gab Fest is aware of this book. It's a new book, a big, huge, like 750-page history book. It's called The Gay Revolution. It's by Lillian Faderman. And it's kind of the 20th century LGBTQ history told. It's a survey, you know, so everything is covered. And it's told through the stories of the people who were involved, so the people who made history. And it's really well written. And I think, you know, first when I first started it, I thought, oh, this will be great for like straight people who don't know gay history. But actually, many members of the community also don't know that much about history, because there weren't the publications and everything happened on a local level. So I think everybody could really learn a ton from it, and it's really well written. So, The Gay Revolution.
Excellent. Well, thanks to our producer, Ann Haberman, who's right over there. She's the one, by the way, who picks the awesome music for the podcast every time. She's like, that is her just special, special genius. Thanks to Andy Bowers, the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Our intern is Jesse Chasen Tabor. The Double X Gab Fest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page, slate.com/xx, to find out more about this show. Facebook page is facebook.com/XXGabFest to talk to us and each other about what you want us to talk about and what you thought about this show. Email, if you want to be more private, XXGabFest@slate.com. And we always read those emails and often comment on them on the next show. Or you can subscribe to us on iTunes, so more people can find out about the show. And of course, thank you to you, our awesome live audience, for being so great. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you again in 2 weeks.
WASHINGTON, baby, DC. WASHINGTON, baby, DC.
Washington, DC.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.